I'm not actually a preacher. I'm going to speak to you this morning about myself and how God's worked with me. I'm 62. I've been a Christian for 16 years. I gave my life to the Lord when I was 46. And a lot happened between 0 and 46. So I'm going to speak to you about forgiveness. It's very, very important. It's been very important in my life. And God has really taught me an awful lot about forgiveness. Okay, now when I was a child, I was about 6 years old. And by the way, this is not for sympathy or anything like that. This is just what happened. It's not a big deal anymore. God's brought me through all that. All my past is my past. The future is the future, and this is the present from God. So I'm not bothered about anything. So when I was about 6 years old, I came home from school one day. My brother was 9. I was 6. And we came home, and my grandmother and my auntie were standing on the doorstep waiting for us. And my auntie said to my brother, "Okay, Pete, you're going to come with me. I'm going to look after you for a while." And my nan said to me, "Come on, boy, let's go." She was a real hard old country woman. She had a permanent fag in her mouth from the time she woke up to the time she went to bed. Right eye closed all the time because the smoke was in her eye. And you can imagine a real hard-faced old woman. And I didn't like her. And off she went. She lived about 3 miles from us, and I was trotting along behind her. We lived in a little cottage. My dad was a farm labourer. My mum was a land girl. And we lived in a little tired cottage. There was no water in the house or electricity or anything like that, but that was how it was. Toilet at the bottom of the garden. Sat on a plank above a bucket. The only problem was you kept getting splinters. But apart from that, it was all right. Anyway, off she went. Halfway there, I thought, whatever's going on? I said, and I remember this ever so well. I said, "Nan, where's Mum?" She said, "She's dead. You ain't got to see her no more, boy." That was it. Morning over. So we went to her house, and I had about a few months with her, and in that few months, it was just, she never spoke. She just said bed, up, breakfast, stuff like that. Well, after a few months, weeks, whatever, my dad turned up. And I hadn't seen him in that time. And he just came in one Sunday, and he said, "Get in the car, we're going." So I went out, he borrowed my uncle's car, we got in the car. And my brother was sitting there in the car, in the back of the car. And he was really smart. He had a lovely little suit on, polished shoes, he had a shirt and tie, and his hair was lovely. And I looked at myself, and in all the time I'd been with my nan, I hadn't had a bath, I hadn't had my hair washed, and I remember thinking, "Sure, he's being well looked after, look at me, I must have looked like Stigger the Dump." And my brother looked at me, and he sort of turned his nose up at me a little bit. And I remember that ever so well, you know, as a kid, I just remember it. And off we went in the car. And we didn't speak or anything like that. We drove, I presume, it must have been for about an hour and a half. And we stopped at this big building. Dad got out, off he walked, and we just followed him down corridors, upstairs, through doors. And eventually he opened a door, and there was my mum in bed. And she looked really, really ill, and she wasn't dead at all. My nan just couldn't be bothered to explain anything, I presume. So Mum was there. And she was really ill, and she kissed my brother, and she said, "Wow, Pete, you look lovely, yeah." And she looked at me, and she sort of frowned. She said, "Who's looking after him, George?" And he said, "My mum." She said, "Oh, right." And that was it. We sat there. Well, I remember her saying to Dad, "It could be a month. They just don't know." She had heart disease, and she'd had a massive heart attack, and she'd dropped down on the ground in the fields. They thought she was dead, but she wasn't. They'd revived her. But because in 1963 they didn't really have any good medication, they sort of gave up on her. So after a while we left. Dad dropped me back off at Nan's, and I was there for months. After a few months, my mum came out of hospital for a while. She was allowed to come home. She was feeling a bit better. They must have had some sort of medication or something. And she was allowed to come out of hospital for a while. We went home, but as our house didn't have any facilities, it was really hard for her. She couldn't really look after me. She couldn't, you know, help me get dressed or bath. We had a bath that we used to bring in the kitchen, you know, and an old tin bath you filled up with water. And so she got ill again, and she had to go back into hospital. She didn't want me to go back to my nan's, so I got farmed out. I went to another auntie. I went to this auntie, and she was all right. But you change schools, you know, you're sort of 6, 7 year old, and you start getting bullied. And nobody wants to accept you in the school. So I was starting to find life a little bit hard. Now, in all this time that I've been a Christian, God has spoken to me, like I say, a lot about forgiveness. And he showed me different things in the Bible. And I'd like to go to Genesis 37:2-33, and this is about Joseph. And I've read and I've studied a lot about Joseph. That's Jacob's son, Joseph. If you've got kids, you'll know the play Coat of Many Colors. I've seen it several times. So I'd like to read this to you, please. Right, Joseph was a young man of 17. He was tending his. Sorry, I think this is a bit. He was a young man of 17. He was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them, his brothers. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he had made a richly ornamented robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. That's a big word, isn't it? They hated him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of corn out in the field when suddenly all the sheaves rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine, and they bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told this to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I've had another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars all bowed down to me." When he told his father as well, his brothers and his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem. And Israel, this Jacob, said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied. So he said to him, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me." Then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron, where Joseph arrived at Shechem. A man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, "What are you looking for?" He replied, "I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are grazing their flocks?" "They have moved on from here," the man answered. "I heard them say they're going to Dothan." So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they had plotted to kill him. Now, that's a really big thing. They're plotting to kill him. They hated him, and they're plotting to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of the cisterns and say that a ferocious animal had devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him in this cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So Joseph came to his brothers. They stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamental robe that he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty. There was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay hands on him. After all, he is our brother." Yeah, he is our brother, so we'll just sell him into slavery. Very kind of them. our own flesh and blood, his brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites. They took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, dipped it in the robe in the blood, and they took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." They're not nice brothers, are they? Okay. So Joseph was in slavery. He was 17 when he was sold into slavery. And although his master looked after him well, he had basically the run of the house, but he was still a slave. And it don't matter what happens in life, you know, if you're not at home with your family and you're away somewhere for 13 years, he was incarcerated, right, in slavery, and then he went into prison later on, you're not in a good place. So just put yourself in Joseph's mind for a minute, right? Now, I've actually done a lot of research on this, and I've read what a lot of theologians have to say about it. And this is how they feel, that Joseph, his brothers hated him, they were jealous of him, so before he even got sold into slavery, up to the age of 17, they must have given him a lot of grief, a lot of hard time, right? They were taking the mick out of him, they were bullying him, they were jealous of him, they didn't believe a word he said. And now eventually they had plotted to kill him, they'd thrown him in a cistern, they pulled him out and sold him into slavery. Can you imagine how he felt? Right? He is going to hate him. It doesn't matter what anybody tries to think about it, he's going to hate him. He's going to be absolutely disgusted with his brothers. As he must have been pulled away, he's looking back on, just laughing and jeering at him. I mean, they'd sat on the edge of the cistern, eating their dinner while he's in there, worrying what's going to happen next. And I know exactly how I would have felt. So there he is now. He's been sold into slavery. So he's got several years down the line. And suddenly his master, who he respects, his master's wife, she wants to have her wicked way with him. So she's trying to get him to sleep with her. And he don't want nothing of it. He's a good, loyal boy. Now, God can bless him. God has blessed him by putting him in a nice home. God has blessed him by having a nice master, but he's still a slave, and he's still getting tormented in there. And his boss's wife, his master's wife, she is really giving him a hard time. Eventually, she pulls his cloak off him, and he runs out into the garden, and she says to the other slaves, "Look, he's been trying to have his way with me. He's been trying to bed me." So his master, who was one of the Pharaoh's top men, his master obviously believed his wife, and he said, "You're going to prison." So he threw him in prison. So there's Joseph now. He's in prison, and he must be even more annoyed. So now he's got his list is getting longer. He must hate his brothers. He must hate his master for putting him in prison, and he hates his master's wife for falsely accusing him. He's in a real, real bad place. Now, with myself, things were getting worse for me. I was with my aunties, and my cousins were a bit jealous of me, so they were bullying me. So I was with another auntie, then I was at a place called Sheldon, and I remember going to the school. I was probably seven, and this is about my third or fourth school, and I saw the bullies coming. 7 years old, right? You shouldn't be thinking violently, should you? 7 years old, and I saw the bullies come out, and I thought, here we go again. So head bully, Honcho, he puts himself in front of me. Before he opened his mouth, I just smacked him straight in the mouth. I thought, well, you know, if I'm going to get bullied, I might as well have some of it, make it worth my while. So the rest of them stood back. They were, like, shocked. So he's crying, you know, because he's a real hard seven-year-old. And he's crying, so I stuck the boot in as well. And I remember that, and I thought, there's power there. You know, I mean, I'm not taking any of it. I've got power in my fist, seven, and I'm thinking that way. So I go home, and my cousins start to bully me. So I'm waiting until nobody's about, And you know what's going to happen. So I gave him a thick ear. And one of my cousins was 9, and me and him, we would fight all the time. Well, then a real terrible thing happened in my life. Right? My dad picked me up and took me to hospital to see my mum, but he brought me to King's Lynn Hospital. She wasn't in Patworth anymore. And he brought me to King's Lynn Hospital. And he said, "You're going to see your mum." I said, "Yeah, great." And when we got there, we went to the maternity ward. Now, my mum, while she was at home on her first home break, she must have, I know now because I'm a clever 62-year-old, but at 7 years old, I couldn't understand where she'd got a baby from. And there she is, and she's got a newborn baby, and she said, "Look, this is your lovely sister." And I hated her. I hated my sister. From that minute, from the day she was born, I didn't have the time of day for her. And my thoughts were, she's got her, she's going to look after her, but she can't look after me. I'm stopping with everybody. I'm having a real hard time in life. And there she is, she's got this newborn baby. So I was gutted. I was really, really fed up. And I went away, and I think that was a turning point in my life where I just started to hate everybody. I couldn't see any good in anything anymore. And I got taken back to another auntie. And I remember I was in one room, and there was 4 or 5 aunties in another room, and they were having a bit of a row over who was going to have me, and they drew short straws, if you like. And I went with another auntie, another school. So as soon as I walked into school, I'm like, "Who's the hardest boy in the school?" And I went across and gave him a hiding because I was in a bad place. So that was how life was going for me. Now, getting back to Joseph, in Genesis 40:1-23, sometime later, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the same prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard assigned them to Joseph, and he attended them. After they had been in custody for some time, each of the two men, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, were being held in prison. They had a dream on the same night. Each dream had a meaning of its own. That isn't a coincidence, is it? Now, God has given them the dreams. He's trying to get Joseph into a good place where he can use him. He can bless him. He can use him with these small things in prison. But God wants to use him tenfold. He wants to use him in a massive way. But he's struggling because I think he's got hatred in his heart. And he's struggling with him. He can't let him out of the prison until he's sorted this hatred out. So when Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw that they were dejected. So he asked Pharaoh's officials who were in custody with him in the master's house, "Why are your faces so sad today?" "We both had dreams," they answered, "but there is no one to interpret them." Then Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams." So the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream. He said to him, "In my dream I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were 3 branches. As soon as it budded, it blossomed, and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. I took the grapes, I squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup in his hand." "This is what it means," Joseph said to him. "The 3 branches of 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to the position, to your position. And he will put Pharaoh's cup back in your hand, just as you used to do when you were his cupbearer. But when all goes well, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. For I was forcibly carried off from the land of the Hebrews. And even here I have done nothing to deserve being put in the dungeon." Does that show you a man who's got forgiveness in his heart? Now, I think he's well angry. When the chief baker saw that Joseph had given a favorable interpretation, he said to Joseph, "I too have a dream." He's not going to be smiling for long, is he? "On my head were 3 baskets of bread. In the top basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh. But the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head." "This is what it means," Joseph said. "The 3 baskets are also 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head and hang you on a tree. That's bad news. And the birds will eat away your flesh. Now the third day was Pharaoh's birthday, and he gave a feast for all his officials. He lifted up the heads of the cupbearer and the chief baker in the presence of his officials. He restored the cupbearer to his position, so that once again put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph has said to them in his interpretation. The chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. Why did he forget him? Because God didn't want him to remember him. Simple as that. God's not got Joseph in the right place, so he's not going to remember him. Joseph must have been in prison. 2 years went by, and Joseph's thinking, he'll remember me soon. He'll remember me. I interpreted that dream. I told him that he was going to get out of here. How can he possibly forget me? I mean, it doesn't record people's thoughts in the Bible, but that's, you know, the opinion of many. That's what he must have been thinking, pacing up and down for 2 years. After 2 years had gone past, why have you forsaken me, God? Why have you forgotten all about me? Here I am stuck in the prison. The chief cupbearer's out. He's back in his rightful position. Right? He's forgotten me to Pharaoh. You gave me the interpretation of the dreams, yet now I'm still stuck here. Why? Lord, I forgive my brothers for everything that they've done. Lord, I forgive my master and his wife. But you've got to get me out of here, please, Lord. I've really, really had enough. He's been in prison now for 13 years. He's now 30 years old, right? And he's had a gutful, isn't he? He's got to get out. So, Pharaoh's dream. In Genesis 41:1. When 2 full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing on the Nile. Right, okay, we don't need to go there. However, we know that Pharaoh had the dream and the cupbearer then remembered him. He remembered him. Why did he remember him? And I believe it's because of the forgiveness. So God can use us all if we're in a bad place, and he can bless us all. But God can only use us mightily when we have total forgiveness in our hearts. If we have unforgiveness in our hearts, right, we have bitterness. If you have bitterness in your heart and you are angry with somebody and you bury it deep down inside, right, you've got to make sure when you bury it, it's dead. If you bury it alive, one day it's going to come up and it's going to bite you. Because imagine Joseph, right? Imagine it was then another 9 years before he saw his brothers. So he's 39 when he saw his brothers again. So he hasn't seen his dad now and his family for 22 years. So he would have been, if he hadn't had forgiveness in his heart, he'd have been in a real bad place. So imagine Pharaoh has now raised him up. He's got him in a really good place. We've had the 7 years of abundance of the crops, right? And now 2 years of the terrible crops. And his brothers are now getting hungry. The father's getting hungry. So the father sends him up to Egypt. And he says, go and buy some grain. I hear they've got plenty up there in Egypt. Get me some food and bring it back. When they get up there, Joseph is standing there, right? And suddenly, his brothers come up and they're presented in front of him, right? The old John Claxton would have thought, God, you've really put them in a good place for me. Out with the sword. All right, all of you, kneel down. Wouldn't you? Because you're in a real bad place with them. Because if that anger had been buried alive, it's going to come up and it's going to get them, right? But because it was buried dead, he must have had that forgiveness. And if it was buried dead, when he saw his brothers, all right, he had a little bit of fun with them, but basically he had a tear in his eye, he had to turn away. That's love. He had love for his brothers. The way they treat him, and he had love for them. They hated him. They took the mick out of him. They wanted to kill him. They threw him in the cistern. They sold him into slavery. I mean, even his master, while he was there, he got to be Pharaoh's number two. His ex-master was under him, right? You'd have been had a bit of a word with him, wouldn't you? You know, around the back of the pub one night. Look here, can we have a word, mate? Right? You put me in prison for nothing. Your wife falsely accused me. We've got to sort this out. Now, I've got something to read to you. Studies on unforgiveness, right? Compassionate UK says, recent studies on unforgiveness show that practicing forgiveness can improve your mental and physical health. So it's not just about forgiving someone. It's not just about burying that anger. My wife, she's... Sorry, I'm not looking at Facebook. I'm just finding something to read to you. My wife, she's got some acid problems, acid reflux, sorry, problems at the moment. So she went onto the internet and she thought, I'm going to try and research this acid reflux and see what I find. This is in a medical journal. Nothing to do with the Bible, nothing to do with Christianity. This is a medical journal. This is what she sent to me. Forgive everyone. Did you know that unforgiveness is classified in medical books as a disease? This is not what she wrote me. This is actually what is on the internet in the medical journal. Classified books as a disease. Sorry, unforgiveness is classified in medical books as a disease. While harboring emotions like anger, resentment, regret is harmful or even deadly, forgiveness can lead to huge health rewards, lowering the risk of heart attack, improving cholesterol levels and sleep, reducing pain and bouts of anxiety, depression, and stress. Forgiveness can be defined as a conscious, deliberate decision to release feelings of resentment or vengeance towards a person or group who has harmed you, regardless of whether they actually deserve your forgiveness. It does not mean you must forget, deny, or excuse their behavior. It just means that you free yourself, not them, of deeply held negative feelings. Forgiveness practices, I know, is a short but powerful ancient Hawaiian prayer called, I'm sorry, please forgive me, thank you, I love you. Just saying those four lines in any order when thinking about people who have harmed you is heart-opening. Be sure to say the prayer for yourselves. Self-forgiveness may be even more powerful, reducing the risk of clinical depression and improving health by lowering markers of inflammation. Whether or not you have an autoimmune condition, addressing stress in your life is hands down one of the best ways to improve your health outcome. Take heart in knowing that when you proactively engage the relaxation response, you improve your immune, repair damaged tissues, and become better able to deal with life's inevitable stresses. And the devil sent me an email right at that time, and it comes straight over the top of it. So, forgiveness. Okay. I'm going to tell you about the problems that I had with forgiveness. I've told you about my background. I've got one more grandmother I'd like to tell you about. My mum's mum. When nobody else would have me, and all was her loss, I was about 9, 10 maybe, they had a meeting, all my relatives, and I ended up with my grandmother, my mum's mum. My mum's mum and dad didn't used to call them alcoholics in those days, they used to call them boozers. They were boozers, and they went to the pub every single night, and they went to the pub all weekend. They used to go to an old pub with a piano and sing all the old London songs, you know, Roll Out the Barrel and everything. And I got stuck with my nan. So before I even set foot in the door, my nan hated me. She couldn't stand me. And I remember going around there, because what had happened now, she's got to look after me, and she can't go to the pub. So, what happened? She used to give me a right belting for no reason whatsoever, and it was just because she was anxious, because she couldn't have her drink. So I used to get thrashed. Anyway, my granddad said, Eva, you've got to stop this. This is not good. I don't want you to touch him anymore. And I remember that, thinking, phew, that was lucky, you know. Anyway, my nan had another way of getting me. What she used to do, at 9 years old, she used to get me. She'd get a piece of flesh, and she would drag me into the bathroom, and she said, he's filthy, Charles, to my granddad. She'd put me in a bath, and she'd get the old floor scrubbing brushes, the big wooden scrubbing brush with the really strong bristles that you used to scrub the floors with. She'd get carbolic soap, and she'd scrub me with it, top to bottom, and she'd totally scrub me. And she'd take off a couple of layers of skin. And that was her way of punishing me. And I remember I used to see her, you know, when she was angry, I used to see her get the car, put the brush and the soap and put me in the bathroom. I thought, oh, no. And she used to drag me in there. Anyway, every night, Granddad used to say, right, I'm going down to the pub. She said, well, bring me back a couple of bottles of Guinness. And he said, yeah, all right, Eva, no worries. And he'd go down the pub. He'd leave the house about 8 o'clock. And before he left, he used to make sure I was in bed so she couldn't get me. So he'd say, go to bed, be quiet, and go to sleep. I'd say, all right, Granddad. And as soon as he was out of the house, she used to come in, get up and get dressed. So I used to have to get up and get dressed. She'd say, right, go up to the pub. He'd be at the Spread Eagle. She'd say, go to the Hob in the Well and get me 2 bottles of Guinness. So I'd have to run up to the pub. They didn't have these 18-year-old rules in those days. You used to go up to the pub, get her 2 bottles of Guinness, come back, give her the Guinness. She'd say, bed. And I'd go to bed. About 10 o'clock, she'd come in, wake me up. She'd say, right, take the empties up to the pub and get number sixpence back on the bottle. So I'd have to run back up the pub, come back, get whacked, back to bed again. I'd get in bed. My granddad would come in about 15 minutes later. She'd say, God. She said, where have you been? I'm gasping for a drink. I ain't had a drink all night. And I'd be like, you lying old lady, you know. And he'd come in and he'd say, why are you awake, John boy? I put you to bed hours ago. Why are you laying awake? Can't sleep, granddad. Anyway, this went on for years. And I got fed up with it. And one day I told my auntie. So she got my nan and she turned around and said, you can't keep doing this to this boy. So anyway, I came home from school and my bag was on the doorstep. And I knocked on the door. I said, Nan, Nan. She said, go away, you lying, horrible kid. She said, I don't ever want to see you again. So I ran away. And I was gone for a little while. And then my dad found out. He found out where I was, come and got me and took me back again. And I had to live with her for another couple of years. Same sort of thing. And I hated her. I really did hate her. And eventually, when I was 14, my mum, with medication and medical science, my mum was actually still doing well. She was, she'd been in hospital most of her life in Papworth. She used to live in Papworth, and there was a rehabilitation centre in Stanton. She lived there a lot. My sister now had been farmed out. She was being looked after by another auntie. She was there full time. My brother was with the other auntie. He was there full time. And I hated him. I hated him. I thought, why? Why had they done that to them? I mean, I didn't think for 1 minute that I was a nuisance. But and it was my fault, but I don't know, it might have been. But I hated him for this. And I hated my nans, and I hated my dad because he never came to see me. And I had real hatred in my heart. And I was 14, and they said, right, you can go back and live with your mum and dad. My mum was on her bed in the lounge, and she couldn't really do anything, but at least she could come home, you know. But she couldn't look after my sister. And my brother didn't want to come home. He was happy. He lived with my auntie because he was having a good time. Toilet in the house and all that. So he was loving it. 14 years old, just 15, I was working at the end of the road. I worked in a garage. And I remember going home every day, and I was dreading it. I used to dread going home because I was worried that I was going to find my mum dead in bed. And I used to worry. Every day I used to worry, and my dad used to get onto me, and I hated it. And so I joined up, you know, as you do, nothing else better to do. So I joined the forces. So as soon as I got in the forces, the first day, it all sort of came back to me, and I thought, there was 120 of us all joined up on the same day. And we went down, and I wanted to find out who the toughest one was so I could knock him out. Because I wanted to be the leader of the pack. You know, you've got to be in a position where people don't bully you, where people don't give you grief. So it didn't start out too well. I spent the next 10 years in the forces. They tried to vent my anger by putting me into the boxing team, and I used to get drunk. I mean, at one point when I started smoking when I was 7, I started drinking when I was 10. I had a tattoo at 14 because I used to ride with a gang of bikers, and that way I could prove that I was 18 and drink with them. So, rough time, but as I said, it's all in the past now. God's looked after me, you know, as he did with Joseph. So Joseph, he's in this good place. He's looking after his brothers now, and he's got total forgiveness. But God, well, I met my wife. I come out of the force. A bit rough, but anyway. I come out of the force, and I met my beautiful, lovely wife. Now, I've just painted a picture of myself. It's not very pretty, is it? My father-in-law sitting there, who loves me. And when I met my wife, I had an ex-wife and three kids. I didn't like her much either. And when I met my wife, we fell in love, and she saw somebody else. But others around me could see this other person, this horrible person who was divorced with three kids, used to fight a lot. Even when I was married, even when I was with Teresa, I was still fighting. I was still a drunkard. And Teresa was going to church. She had a church in King's Lynn that she went to. And then she decided to come to King's Lynn Christian Fellowship Church when the kids were young. So she came here. We were together. She came here, and she came home, and she started telling me about God. And I didn't want to know. And I thought, how can God love me? How can God forgive me? How can God care one little bit about me? When I was in the forces, I mean, I did some real bad stuff. Some, you could say it was unforgivable stuff, right? I'm definitely not proud of it. I'm ashamed of it. But how could I possibly give my life to the Lord when I had that rubbish inside me? I used to sit on the settee at night drinking. She'd go to bed and I'd sit there and I'd say, God, how can you care about me? How could you ever love me? You love my wife. She's a lovely woman. You love my kids. I came to church a couple of times, Father's Days and things like that, and I'd look around and I'd think, all these lovely people. Actually, I didn't know them then. But I thought, all these lovely, wonderful people, right, and here I am, the scum of the earth. I can't possibly join in here. I can't have anything to do with it. Well, all these lovely people were praying for me, and God was, he was kept trying and trying and in different ways. And I went to, started going to the cell group with my wife, PG group, Bible study, and I started going with her, and I just liked these people. And one night I just thought, I really want to be a Christian. I just want to be a Christian. So Tim Porter, he led me to the Lord, and he said, we went through it, and he said, how do you feel? And I said, yeah, great. And I was lying to him, to be honest, because I went away and I thought, this is not for me, you know. This really ain't for me. I still had these bad feelings. All of that hatred and that anger I'd buried, but I'd buried it alive. And I couldn't bear to face the past. I couldn't bear to face the people I knew from the past, because when I did, I got really angry. I really used to. It wasn't good. Anyway, eventually, the kids, Tessa and Johnny, something was going on in the church. I don't remember what. And they said, come to church, Dad. I said, no, it's not for me. They said, you're a Christian now, Dad. Come to church. I said, no, it's not for me. You know, I want to work on the car, you know. I don't want to go to church. They went on and on and on, and I came. And God went on and on and on. So I came, and I sat over there where Colin is. And I sat there one Sunday morning, and I had my head down, and everybody's up singing, and I thought, oh, what a lovely bunch of people, but I don't fit here. I started to have a panic attack. I felt sick. I didn't know what I was going to do with myself. I felt so bad. And Dawn came up to the front, and Dawn said, I've got a word for somebody. She said, I don't know who you are. She said, but God's told me you're as welcome here as anybody. She said, there is nobody here who's better than you or worse than you. She said, you're all God's children, and you are God's child, and don't forget it. And all the hair stood up on the back of my neck, and I thought, oh, my life, that's for me. Why would God want to speak to me? Why would he care about me? And we went home, and the next week, Teresa said, you've got to try it again. I said, yeah, I will. So I came, sat there again, got my head down again. I thought this would be over soon. And I sat there, and I'm not going to tell you this part of the story because that's my testimony, and there's a lot went on. But basically, I saw Jesus. Jesus came to me, he put his arms around me, he hugged me. I'll tell you, I was 46 years old. I'd never cried. I'd never cried. I was hard-hearted. There was no softness in me at all. And Jesus came and he hugged me. And he forgave me. We didn't speak. People say, what did you say? What did you say? I didn't say anything. What do you need to say? He's the truth. He's the light. He's everything. He hugged me and he just walked away. And I started crying. I couldn't stop crying. I cried for 2 weeks. And I went home and God started to speak to me. He said, John, I love you. I love you unconditionally. Sorry. He said, now I forgive you for your past, John. Everything that you've done. We don't even want to talk about that. I forgive you, John. He said, but you've got to forgive yourself now, son. He said, you've got to forgive yourself. Before you can move to the next stage, you've got to forgive yourself. And I sat there and I thought, that's the problem. I can't forgive myself. I can't forgive myself for everything that I've done. And I worked on it. And me and Daryl was only talking about this morning. Next week, Daryl, he was a young pastor at the time, and he was preaching, and he had an altar call, and he said, anybody got any problems? I'll come forward. And I sat there just crying and crying, and he came up and he said, what's the matter? I said, I don't know. He said, can I help us? No. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what was wrong, but I was forgiven myself. It was all coming out of me. You know, I cried for 2 weeks. I couldn't stop. I was going home. I was crying all the time. I went to work. They kept saying, I'm all right. Yeah. Bang my hand. Yeah. I just kept crying and crying and crying. So that's the first forgiveness that God taught me, to forgive yourself. All right. After that, all right, you've got to forgive yourself. Then you've got to learn to forgive anonymously. What does that mean? I know. Right, I hated my nans. I did. I hated my brother and I hated my sister. And God said, you've got to forgive them. So I forgave them. My nans were dead, so that was easy. So I said, right, I do. I forgive them, Lord. I forgive my grandparents for what they did. I forgive them, Lord. It's all in the past. It's forgotten about. I forgive them. And so that one came out. That was gone. That was dead and buried, right? I forgave my aunties and my uncles. That was all gone and forgotten about. I forgave my brother. He bullied me, you know, and things like that. And he weren't the best of big brothers, but I forgave him. You know, we became friends after that. My sister, I couldn't forgive her for being born. I just couldn't forgive her. I hated her. And it don't matter what I did. I said, I can't forgive her, Lord. I tried. We became friends for a little while, and I just said, I can't. She was horrible to Teresa. She was... You know, she didn't like me. She knew I didn't like her, so she didn't like my family. And I said, I cannot forgive her, Lord. I said, God, how can I sit in the same room as that girl when I don't like her? I said, God, how can I talk to her when I don't like her? How can I look at her when I don't like her? God said, you silly boy, have I asked you to be friends with her? He said, I haven't asked you to be friends with her. I've asked you to forgive her. You've got to get her out of you, son. He said, that's got to be gone. He said, if somebody burgled your house, keyed your car up, he said, if somebody set light to your garage and ruined my classic car, right? He said, I would never expect you to be friends with them. He said, how could you be friends with such a ruthless person? You've got to forgive. I said, I understand, Lord. I've got to forgive anonymously. She doesn't have to know about it because it's got nothing to do with her. It's between me and God. It's between us. I've got to forgive her. Now, God, as in Joseph, how could God use me for the future? He could only bless me at the point, that time, that day. But he couldn't use me for the big things of the future if I had hatred. If my sister walked through the door now, I'd smile at her. I wouldn't feel any hatred. I wouldn't feel any animosity. I wouldn't feel anything. I'd say hello to her and anything. We're not the best of friends or anything like that, but I would feel no badness towards her, right? It's gone and forgotten about. Now, I've got to tell you something. I hated gypsies. I'm saying that. I hated gypsies, right? I had a run-in with some gypsies. They beat me up really badly. It's my fault I went after them. I got beat up really badly. I had 3 months where I couldn't work. I had a fractured skull. I had a split sinus tube. But now I've got problems with nose. They want rubber eight on it. And I hated gypsies. I hated their Jack Russells, right? I hated their ponies. I hated their caravans. I hated that they ate hedgehogs, right? I don't know if they did. There is nothing I liked about gypsies, right? Nothing. I had a gypsy site right behind me, and I hated them. But God's good. God's got a fantastic sense of humor. He loves us immensely. I haven't been coming to church very long. That room there, that was the hospitality room. And in come Barry and Karen, who just happened to be gypsies. And they came in. Barry was all right, but Karen wanted to fight me. Right? Anyway, they sat down, and we had a cup of coffee, started chatting. I said, where are you from? He said, we live in Egypt now, but we're travelers. I've got to go to the toilet. I said, what have you done, God? You sent gypsies in the church. They come and torment me. Barry and Karen are the nicest, loveliest people I've ever met in my life. I love them dearly. They're good friends of mine. And we get on really, really well. And God knew that. And he knew that he'd got to send them here for me. Because when they came, after seeing that, you can't tar a whole nation with the same brush as one person who's been a bad person. You can't say that all of Germany is horrible because of Hitler. I love Barry and Karen, and I forgave the whole gypsy nation. Right? Everybody. I love their ponies. I love their Jack Russells, and I've even got a white van myself. Right? So God had to get that out of me. Right? And I thought it was all over. I really thought it was all over. I thought, wow, Lord, you've brought me through such a tremendous thing. I've forgiven my sister. I've forgiven the gypsy nation. I've forgiven my dead grandparents. I've forgiven everybody. I'm laughing. I'm singing and dancing, right? Anyway, about 3 months ago. Oh, I forgot one. Sorry. I put my glasses on. I can see it now. We've got to have instant forgiveness in our hearts. Darren knows what that means. We had it this morning. You've got to have instant forgiveness in your heart. If your wife, or your husband in some cases, your partner, if they say something you don't like, you don't fly off the handle. You've got to have instant forgiveness. You've got to say, well, she might not like that, I might like that, but we've got to meet somewhere in the middle. And you've got to forgive, because otherwise, if you don't, it can turn into a row. You know, and people say, oh, we had a right row over the dog we've never had. Because if we got one, she wants a Jack Russell and I want a Golden Retriever, right? Well, you've got to compromise, and you get something, you know, spaniel, I don't know. But you've got to have instant forgiveness. Now, this morning, we were cut up on a roundabout. The bloke verbaled something. I was driving, but he didn't verbal it at me. He verbaled it at Daryl. But he gave us a load of verbal. I said, all right, you go through then, mate. That's not a problem. Because you've got to have instant forgiveness. Because if you don't, you've got road rage then will develop. It'll be in the lay-by, and we'll end up scrapping and rolling in the dike. Where does that get anybody? So you have instant forgiveness. That's the point. It's long-term forgiveness, it's forgiving the dead, and it's instant forgiveness. Now, about a few weeks ago, I don't remember how long, after I thought it was all behind me, we saw a film called I Can Only Imagine. There's a person who called Bart Millard, and he's got a band called Mercy Me, great Christian band, very famous. Bart Millard, when he was a boy, his dad thrashed him. He really thrashed him. He treated him so badly. And Bart Millard struggled with it no end. And when Bart was about 8 or 9, he went to a Bible weekend. And when he got there, he was given a book, and in that book, it said, I forgive. And then underneath it had a dotted line. And Bart Millard got the book, and he looked at it. And he was being beaten by his dad. He was being treated really badly by his dad. So he threw the book in the cupboard or whatever. He discarded the book. And he went on, and he formed this band, and he left home. He ran away, and he left home, and he formed this band. And the band wasn't very successful. It toured around, and it went from church to church, and basically, he was trying to get big music producers to come and, sorry, it's all right, I'm just looking at something else, sorry. He got these big music producers to come, and they said, no, you ain't no good. So we're not going to produce your music. And he got angry, and he'd throw chairs around, and he'd do this and that. Well, eventually, and there's a reason, you know why he's angry. Because he's buried it alive, and it keeps coming back up, and he's getting angry with everybody. So eventually, Bart Millard hears his dad's dying or whatever, and he goes back, and he sees his dad, and he's really angry with him. But gradually, he starts to soften, he starts to forgive him. And he finds this book, and he reads it. I forgive. And on the dotted line, he put my dad. And as he put my dad, God said to me, that's for you, John. Because I knew I hadn't forgiven my dad. My dad, you know, I mean, because he didn't even visit me, I was angry with him. Because he didn't speak to me, we never had a conversation once. I was angry with him. And I was really annoyed with my dad, and I hated my dad. And at the end, when Bart put down my dad, I just burst out crying. And I said, Lord, I forgive my dad. I love him and I forgive him. Forgive him for everything that he's done. And God turned around then and said, now you can move forward. Now I can use you. You know, because it's all gone. And I feel today that somebody or someone, some of you, have got a problem with unforgiveness, whether it's because you haven't forgiven yourself, whether it's because you haven't forgiven others. You know, somebody, somewhere. And God is using me today. This is the first time I've stood up here in front of everybody, apart from a two-minute testimony or something. It's the first time today. And God is now using me as he used Joseph. All right, I haven't got to feed a nation. But he got to a point where he could use him. And I feel I've got to a point where he can use me. So we're going to play the record now, I Can Only Imagine. And after that's finished, I'm going to stand down here at the front, and if anybody would like to come and talk to me about it, if anybody would like me to pray for them, pray with them. I will. And what you've got to remember is, having unforgiveness in your heart isn't something to be ashamed of, right? It's something you've got to get rid of, right? Having unforgiveness in your heart and speaking to somebody about it isn't the problem. The problem is holding it back. The problem is holding it down here. Because one day, it's going to jump up, and it's going to bite you on the back. So you've got to get it out. Thank you for listening to me. And here's the record.
I'll just play this just to put some context to it so you understand. It's not a song quote about forgiveness, but this was Mercy Me's first big hit that after all this forgiveness, they got signed, the band went big, God began using them in the whole worship and this was the first song that they wrote that really people began to hear of this band. It's the first time I ever heard of them, and so that's why the relevance of this song to this moment. Just play it, and as John says, just allow people a moment to reflect, just close your eyes, listen, think through some of this. If it's hit a chord with you, if it resonates with you, then just, you know, allow God to work that through with you, and then we'll close the meeting.